morning. How's everyone doing? Sorry about yesterday. Mother Nature, when she cries, she cries. But we needed the water anyway. So what I've got, because we had 3 hours yesterday, do you have any time this week, 2 hours minimum, or an hour next week? In the afternoon? Or in the morning? In the morning, I'm tied up. How about Friday? Do you have anything on Friday morning? 8 to 7. Oh, man. You have quite a day. Huh? I have a meeting from 3 to 3:30. Let's see. Well, look at your schedule. I'm going to take a just look at your schedule. Give me some times, sometime, because the review we can do from 8 to 10. I got to find a room on the 28th, which is a Friday. So if you can find some time from between now and then, if it's 1 hour blocks, three times, or 1 2-hour block, one hour. What time? I've got class. We've got That's right. You're not scheduled for class for this, are you?
Nope.
So is the morning completely free?
Yep. We need to be at state by 12:30.
No problem. Let me get a room and we'll schedule for that. How's that?
2 hours.
2 or 3. Well, I have 3 hours. That's mm-hmm. So it'd be from 8 to 11.
That works.
And that gives you plenty of time to get to San Francisco State, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So let me get a room on. See, Saul, I knew you guys are good. Thank you very much. All right. So the midterm is coming up 2 weeks from today, a week before the election. So there's the sandwich effect. So the topics we have to cover are going to be neoplasia and this topic, which we're going to start today, and that's fluid and hemodynamic derangements. And this is combining what you learn in physiology and what happens to the pathophysiology when you alter fluids within the various compartments within the human body. The key thing about this hemodynamic arrangement of fluids that you always have to worry about is hypoxia. When we talk about any of these things, it's hypoxia. Because remember, what's the most common cell injury that we have to worry about is hypoxia. So when we're moving fluids from various compartments, what are the three compartments you think of clinically? Is obviously in the intravascular volume. The conduits are our blood vessels and heart. That's one space. The next space is the interstitium in tissues. The third space is going to be the cells themselves. So you have to think of the compartments, because our body cavities are not compartments normally, because they don't have a lot of fluid at all. But the three compartments you have to think of where fluids can move in and out is intravascular, extravascular. Within the extravascular space, you have to think of the extracellular space around the cells, and then the third space is the cells themselves. Because we know, if cells get injured, what ion comes into the cell? That water follows it everywhere. Wherever this ion goes, water will follow. Sodium. So if that sodium switches from one compartment to the next, what will follow it all the way? Water. That's the key concept. Because you're going to see when we talk about this, if we move volumes, especially from the intravascular space to the extravascular space, what's going to happen to your blood pressure? We go into shock, where we have decreased perfusion and we have systemic hypoxia. That's going to be one of the topics at the end. So this fluid shift is very important. This is what I look at when I see a patient or a tissue that's injured. We talked about acute inflammation. We have to think of that tissue is a circuit inside of it. And the circuit obviously is the cardiovascular circuit. Well, tissues like the cartilage does not have any vessels, so that's an exception. Or tendons and ligaments don't have a lot of blood supply to them. But we get the thing is the arterial, where you get providing nutrients and oxygen. We have the capillaries, where gas exchange is now taking place, O2 is coming in, waste products and CO2 like that is coming out and moving out, and we have deoxygenated blood. Fluid moves because of the permeability, the pressure. So if there's any problem with permeability, that's one way you can get fluid out of the intravascular space, because there's higher pressure, especially on the arterial side. And so we talked about that in what process? Acute inflammation. You get two more because you increase permeability, the endothelial cells retract. Second important mechanism that makes fluid go to the extravascular space is pressure. That's why if you stand on your feet all day, your feet will swell because the pressure is pushing fluid out. That's why the best time to buy shoes is not at night, is at night, not in the morning. Because in the morning, your feet have very little fluid, as long as you've been sleeping vertical, but horizontal. But when you work all day, if you go that day you told me from 8 to 7, you're going to have bigger feet at the end of the day. Okay? And so this is something you have to realize. Another important thing is, what's ion is in the tissue? If the ion is a lot of sodium, water will follow it. Because you want to get the volume back into the tissue, you have to have two ways of getting that volume that's in the extravascular space. One, you have a protein, albumin, made by hepatocytes in the liver that's going to bring it in. Because as the water leaves, or the fluid leaves, the concentration of protein goes up in the vessels, the post-capillary venules, for example, and that's going to, an osmotic load, bring water back in. But it's not 100%. So you need what? Lymphatics in your tissues. The lymphatics will now draw the rest of that fluid and re-enter it into the intravascular space through your lymphatic system to your venous system. So that's how you think of the movement of fluid between the intravascular space, extravascular space, and within the cells themselves, like we saw in cell injury. So when somebody comes in with a swollen foot or leg, you have to think about it in those terms, that there was intravascular space that's now, the fluid has now either been in the cells or in the tissue or both. Like in the case of acute inflammation, you have both. Because as cells become injured in tissue, sodium comes into the cell, water goes in there. Then you have increased permeability, water comes into the extravascular tissue. So now you've moved it. Well, that was interesting. Who turned the lights on? Yeah, no, didn't he see us in here? There we go. I don't know. Oh, anyway, a phantom, it was a ghost. What can I tell you? Does that make sense? You see how you have to think of patients. When they come in swollen, it's not always inflammation, because I'll show you that in a minute. So we're going to talk about edema, we're going to talk about congestion, increased pressure. We're going to talk about hemostasis, because people get injured. We got to prevent the intravascular space being lost. When you cut yourself, you've injured blood vessels or the chambers of a heart. Whatever it may be, we have to have some way of plugging it up. Then we have to worry about the blood slow thrombus forms in the intravascular space, and it can cause occlusion, lead to an infarct. We'll talk about where it breaks off and travels and obstructs flow to tissue and leads to obstruction and hypoxia. Then we'll talk about infarct, whether it's an infarct in your heart, a heart attack, coagulative necrosis, or infarct in your brain because of a stroke. Then we're going to talk about hemorrhage, the various names that clinically you should be aware of, that when you hear it, you understand that you're losing intravascular volume into tissues, spaces, as a consequence of injury, and then shock. We have total circulatory collapse. We cannot deliver blood to tissue or meet the demands of the metabolic demands of the human body. Those are the topics that will be covered. These are very important. These are recurrent things that everyone, especially physical therapists, have to feel very comfortable with. And when you go to these clinic interludes and you see these things like swelling, always ask yourself about what's going on in applying these principles. All right, let's talk about edema. So now when I think of edema, I think of my hand, or my foot, doesn't matter. Five toes, five fingers. When somebody comes in and they have swelling, I have to think of it in the following way. Has there been injury to the intravascular cells or the wall to make them leaky? What do we see? Acute inflammation. It's classic for it, where it's making it leaky. If you have increased hydrostatic pressure, somebody's been standing on their feet all day or swelling, or if their heart is not pumping properly, the blood will back up in the venous side on the left, on the right side, and that hydrostatic pressure in the legs, and you'll get pedal edema as a consequence of this. But it's not going to be rubor, and it's not going to be painful, because that's acute inflammation, and that's different, but both lead to swelling. So that's why you distinguish between edema and inflammation What is it due to? The inflammation or hydrostatic pressure? What's the sodium? What's the ion we have to worry about in tissue if there's too much? Is sodium. So that's why if you eat a lot of salty foods, you can increase the amount of sodium in your tissue, plus your intravascular, and that's what one of the causes of hypertension is, eating a lot of salty foods, because what follows sodium everywhere? And so increase the volume, increase pressure, whether it's in the tissue, the cells, or the intravascular volume. If you can't make albumin or you can't, it's lost. So what's the organ that you destroy that can lead to this is the liver. So cirrhosis, you have a patient who has damaged their liver due to a virus like hepatitis B or C, or they have alcohol, autoimmune, doesn't matter. Some type of liver injury can't make the albumin, can't bring the fluid back in from the extravascular tissue and into the intravascular space. So now you get edema. Then obviously, if you lose protein, what is an example? If you have somebody with severe burns and you have this huge organ, the skin, you cause those capillaries in the first 24 hours of a burn to be very leaky. So you can lose intravascular volume plus albumin, and now you're gonna have a problem. Not only to the injury, but also you don't have the ability to bring back the fluid that's in the tissue because you have no albumin that's leaked out and throughout the skin. Yes. It's a, think of it as a solute. Go back, you know, you think of chemistry, you have solutes. The higher the solute that you have in a compartment, you have a semi-permeable membrane, what's going to bring it into it? Water. If the solute is higher on the outside, water will go to the opposite direction. So you think of albumin, it's the most common protein. Protein is very big. It has a lot of atoms to that molecule of protein. So as it is lost, it can't bring in that water because the concentration within the intravascular volume is lower than that in the tissue. Does that make sense? So think of it as a solute. So the higher the solute concentration in the compartment, you have a semipermeable membrane, what always follows it? Water. Think of it, I have too much sodium, what follows it? When you dehydrate, when you exercise, what do you feel like you have to do? You get thirsty. So what do you think happens to the number of solutes in your intravascular volume? The sodium goes up, and now you want to drink, you're thirsty. Because that osmolality has changed now. It could be sodium, it could be albumin. Because what follows both of these molecules? Water, H2O. Does that make? So it's the same principle as sodium. Yes.
Can you explain the difference between swelling and inflammation?
Sure, inflammation is calor, dolor, rubor, and tumor. And that, you're gonna get edema, but the edema is due to one thing. The key in edema when you have it in acute inflammation is that you're gonna cause the blood vessels to what? Vasodilate. So now they're gonna become, and the endothelial cells retract, so you're increasing the permeability, not because of pressure, because you're making the endothelial cells separate, so it's now a very leaky barrier. So dilation, you have more blood flow, it's leakier, and that's why it swells. You're gonna have red. Now if I have edema due to here, I won't have dolor. I won't have rubor, because it's not really, we're not having this massive amount of vasodilation occurring. It's a problem of getting fluid into the tissue because I have no albumin, not enough solutes, too much sodium, or lymphatics. But have we talked about inflammation? See the difference? There's nothing we talked about that has the dolor, calor. See the difference? What do they have both in common? Fluid in the wrong place for two different reasons. Inflammation, increased permeability. In the case of everything else that you get fluid in there, it's obstruction, too much sodium in the tissue, not enough albumin, or not lymphatics. See the difference? Does that make sense? Just think about it. But when you go to the clinic and you see somebody coming in and they just sprain their ankle, well, that's going to be tissue injury. It swells because of two reasons. I've ruptured, if it's purple or violaceous, we know we ruptured red blood cells because of the trauma. It turns purple. But if it doesn't turn purple, it's still swollen. It means I still have caused some injury and it's still painful. And it may eventually, because in soft tissue, we may not see the rubor, but if you were to dissect it, you would see it. versus somebody who's been sitting on or standing on their feet all day. They haven't injured it. You have increased hydrostatic pressure. All you're going to see what? Is swelling. See the difference? You have to think of the mechanisms. And when you look at a patient who comes in with a swelling, always break it down. Which one or more of these is contributing to it? Look at the patient is dying, no pun intended, to tell you the story. All you have to do is listen to them and then ask the questions. How did you get this swelling? What were the circumstances? Okay? So if you take that diagram, we listed these five things. What's the first thing? Anything increases permeability, inflammation. You're taking a vasodilator. Doesn't matter. Two, I increase hydrostatic pressure. The pump fails. So it pumps the blood back on the left side into the lungs. You get pulmonary edema. Can't breathe. It backs up on the right side into your systemic venous system. You're going to get swelling your legs, your arms, your feet, everywhere. Because it's a mechanical problem. Backs up. Three, I got too much sodium in a place that should not be, the interstitium of every tissue. So what follows it? Water. That's why you see more H2O. If I have a problem of I can't bring the fluid in, this is called Stirling's hypothesis. You'll learn this, that's the term they use to describe fluid movement, the Stirling hypothesis in circulatory physiology. So anything that you lose albumin, can't produce it, the liver's dysfunctional or it leaks through the kidney, then we have a problem. And the last thing is lymphatics. What's a classic example of this is when women used to get radical mastectomies. Surgically, they would destroy the axillary lymph drainage here, so the upper extremity on this side wouldn't be able to get the fluid out, and you get these women with larger arm on one side. So this was a surgical scarring, interfere with the lymphatics, you get ipsilateral lymphedema of the upper extremity. So there's a surgical issue or causing trauma to lymphatics and interfering with it. What's an organ that has a real problem with fluid is the brain, because it doesn't have in lymphatics. Plus, it's in a calvarium, a skull. So if you have head trauma, you have any type of infarct, since you're causing leakiness and injury to the tissue, where's that fluid going to be drained out of? It's really the cerebral spinal fluid and getting it back through the circulation. But you don't have any lymphatics. That's why people get swelling in these and they end up herniating, because that's like the brain is the consistency of jello as an adult. If you're a newborn, it's consistency of tofu. For those that like to have consistencies, play with a little tofu sometime. That's playing with the brain of a neonate. If you play with jello, you're playing with your brain.
Was number one increased permeability?
Yes. Right. Just as I, where you see those arrows going in and out, and the classic example that we've talked about is acute inflammation. But hydrostatic pressure can do the same thing too. Now it's pressure rather than a permeability issue. Okay? So edema can be local, like acute inflammation, urticaria, hives or hypersensitivity reaction type 1. You have all those vasodilators, we talked about that in immunopath. You have some venous, so you have arterial, capillary, vein. If it gets obstructed here, compress it, or you obstruct the lumen with a thrombus, what happens? Blood can't get through the capillaries. What happens to the pressure? Goes up. Now you're going to push fluid out into the tissue. Now you get edema into the extravascular tissue where the thrombus is. Or left side of heart failure, the blood backs up into the pulmonary veins, the pressure in the capillaries in your lungs go up, hydrostatic pressure, therefore I get edema. Now I'm swimming in my own, I'm drowning my own fluid, because all that fluid is going into the alveolar sacs. When you swell up like a balloon, we call this term anasarca. It's a great Scrabble word. Okay, look how many A's you can use. Right? And you got to get rid of the S and an R. There you go. Now, what do we think? We're getting global edema throughout the body. So what's the thing that would stop blood and back it up into the venous system? Heart failure, whatever the cause. If I have a problem, I can't make albumin. I destroy the liver, we call it cirrhosis, due to hepatitis B, alcohol, it doesn't matter. I can't make albumin, chloroaminic pressure goes down, I can't bring fluid from the rest of the extravascular tissue, I get edema. If I lose a lot of protein, I damage the glomeruli, where they become very leaky. because the filtrate keeps out protein, but now I lose it in your urine, and the liver can't make enough of it. Decreased glomerular pressure, therefore I lead to edema. Another thing is, this is a selfie cause. And what do I mean by that? Atrogenic means the clinicians. Clinicians who are giving fluids, like if somebody comes in shock, decreased blood pressure, what do you give them? To get their blood pressure up, because you're trying to avoid hypoxia, give them what? IV fluids. Well, you can over-fluid resuscitate a patient, and you can put them into edema. Because if you increase the intravascular volume, that fluid has to go somewhere. You can't pee it out fast enough, so the fluid's going to go where? Because increased hydrostatic pressure into your extravascular tissue, and now you swell up like a balloon. So that's the other thing you have to think about is iatrogenic. So this is the other thing is, you never, can you die of water intoxication? Yes. Extremes of drinking water does not mean you're healthy. Okay. Any water can kill you. And what organ you would be a problem would be your brain. Again, because it doesn't have what in it? Lymphatics. So if you drink a lot of water, what's the organ that's going to swell? Right here. There's a famous story of a mother who wanted to win a game console for her son. There was a contest to see how much water you could drink. Not good. She died of brain herniation because of water intoxication. Moderation is the key to life. O2 can kill you. Water can kill you. So you got to realize that even if you exercise 6 to 7 times a day, every day, that'll kill you too, by the way. Too much exercise. The body was not designed to be abused. The extremes.
Question?
Yes.
Can you explain what's going on with the kidney in the last slide?
The kidney was, it gets leaky. When you filter your blood, you keep your proteins inside the intravascular space. But if you make the kidney leaky in the glomerulus, you lose that protein. What happens to chloride oncotic pressure, like albumin? And then you get systemic edema. We're going to talk about that when we get to the kidney. I don't want to give you too much detail. I can give you as much detail as you like, but I'm just trying. It's called the installment plan. We want to do it in even installments. If I give it all at once, the brain goes swelling, and we don't want that to happen, right? We don't have herniation. Now, this is not to memorize. I'm not trying to give you a heart attack. I'm just showing you what the body does when certain things happens to it in terms of edema. And this is how you think of a patient. If you have a pump failure, you have to think of the pump, the blood is backing up into the venous system because the largest volume of blood in the cardiovascular volume is not in your arteries, but in your veins. That's the greatest amount of volume. So now the cardiac output can't get it out of the heart, whether it's from the right side or the left side. Now what's going to happen is, what's going to happen to the volume? Well, the arterial volume goes down. So now the kidney is a very important regulator to maintain perfusion, to avoid hypoxia, to maintain blood pressure. So it sends out a molecule called renin. And this molecule is going to be important for establishing vasoconstriction, but it's also going to lead to a hormone released from your adrenal gland called aldosterone or mineral corticoid. And what's its function is to keep sodium. So if you retain sodium, what follows sodium? So now the water is retained, sodium goes up, water comes in, the plasma volume goes up, but then you increase the amount of fluid getting into the tissue. Because you increase the fluid volume, what happens to your pressure? It goes up and pushes it out. If the heart backs up, you can see in the venous side, goes up, capillary pressure goes up. So there's another cause. You're having hydrostatic pressure, you're retaining sodium, and these combined is leading to the effect of edema. If you're malnourished, especially proteins, you see these in parts of the world, you see these babies with the stomach, with the abdomen protruded, it's because they have edema. And the reason is they don't have protein in their diet. You just look at them, you can make the diagnosis in 1 second, why their abdomen looks like this. It's swollen because they don't have protein in their diet, so they can't break it down to amino acids to construct now albumin in the liver, and so they don't have chloride oncotic pressure. And so what happens is they get fluid in their body cavities, especially their abdomen. And that's why you can tell they have what is called ascites or effusion there. If you have nephrotic syndrome, the leaky kidney, don't have chloroconic pressure, therefore you can get decreased volume and because of the and lead to edema. Okay? What does it look like? Looks like this, edema. You notice the foot is swollen. One of the things is you walk into see a clinic, if you walked in the clinic, you can look at people's feet. It's amazing what you can find with just look at people's feet, what they're wearing or not wearing. Maybe they come in wearing sandals or flip-flops. Oh, and it's winter time. This doesn't sound right. Because maybe they're swollen. That's why they won't fit in their shoes, because you try putting a shoe on that one, on that foot. So what you can do clinically is to press on it. If it was inflammation, you pressed on it, what would the patient tell you? Pain, dolor. But now if you push on that, what would they tell you? Nada, no pain. Because this is somebody who has heart failure. So if the heart fails, all the blood in the venous blood in your arms and legs are going to increase hydrostatic pressure, and now you're going to see swelling. Do you see any rubor? No. But if you press on it, you'll leave an impression on the patient. This is called pitting edema. Yes? The question is, it depends on how extreme it is. There's a certain point where it will become painful, but it'll be so you won't be able to maybe see the toes.
But that wouldn't be painful.
No. So it's going to be different. You have to put the context. Remember, pain is subjective. Who tolerates pain better, men or women?
Women.
Forget about the movies. It's a bunch of hokum, smoke 'em. It's true. You'll have patients, you'll have male patients that if they have to put an IV or they get a needle, they want a lidocaine, locally anesthetic, to avoid the pain. You put it into a woman, she's talking to you, smiling, and say, oh, you finished? Don't feel anything. So, the movies. You think you've had Trump in a hospital bed, you think he would, you probably want to, he would be under general anesthetic before putting a needle in. Yes. Oncotic pressure means the albumin. It's colloidal oncotic pressure. It's colloid because it's not an ion like sodium. Albumin is a molecule, so they call it colloid. And its oncotic pressure is because it's bringing the water in because of its concentration within the intravascular volume. No. Not at all. Okay? So this is pitting edema. And what you can do with the patient, one of the things you do with the patients like this is you weigh them. Let's say you're going to give them a diuretic. One of the ways you get rid of the fluid is to give them a diuretic to make the kidney get rid of sodium. And if they get rid of sodium, what follows sodium? That's how you get decrease this. So these patients would be weighed every day. They optimize their heart to make their efficient heart so they don't fail. And then you got to get rid of that fluid because it's going to take quite a while. So you give them a diuretic to get rid of sodium, get rid of water, and you got to make sure you don't get rid of too much potassium, and then you have to worry about potassium causing arrhythmia, so you have diuretics that spare the potassium but get rid of the sodium. So what you can do, if you have a patient that's swelling and you want to know if it's an anasarca, you go along the body with your index finger, if you're lefty or righty, it doesn't matter, and gently press on their extremities. You can actually map the edema. So you can go up the leg, up to the knee, and thigh. And you actually see when the pitting ends, that's where the level of water stops. You can do this in the arm, starting from the hands, going up like this, or on the trunk. It's a very simple thing to do. It doesn't cost anything. It's built in. So touching the patient is very important, and that'll tell you. Okay? Any other questions? Try this with your patients. Yes?
So are they like knowingly having heart failure?
Well, they may come in this way. They didn't know what they have. People can't get the health care. Not everyone's insured, right? Do you think everybody goes to the doctor on a regular basis? No. So you may be the first one to make the diagnosis we got a problem here. Or maybe they're eating too much salty foods. So it could be dietary, it could be heart failure, but then they need to be what? Further evaluated to ascertain why are they swelling all the problem. I had a patient to illustrate this. I had a patient who was in this hospital for 4 months without a diagnosis. They came in with a diagnosis of obesity. When you look at a person, please don't make the assumption they're fat, okay? Being big can be due to many reasons, not just having too many bigger fat cells or too many fat cells. This woman was in here coming in, and she was going to get a tummy tuck because they thought she was obese. And she eventually died. At autopsy, when I looked at her body, her arms and extremities were completely normal looking. If you're obese, it's going to distribute everywhere, right? And so her abdomen was like this big. She was beyond pregnancy. We found 26 liters of fluid in her peritoneal cavity. And the reason why she was bigger, because her right side heart was failing, because she had an occlusion in her veins that was missed as a diagnosis. So don't look at a person and say they're big because they're fat. It'll get you into trouble. Don't label patients until you actually know what's going on to make them big. It could be a tumor. It could be obstruction of lymphatics. It could be too much sodium they're eating in their diet. It could be a heart problem. It could be a problem in the lung that's making a problem for the heart. So it's a domino effect. So keep an open mind. Don't just throw it out there and, oh, you must be fat. Yet the patient's always telling you a great story. Just have to listen to them. Any other questions? Now you're experts in edema. Now you test each other. Test your feet at the end of the day. You feel a little bit of edema. Then you lift your legs. What's going to happen to that fluid? It equilibrates and we start to go again. So these are definitions of fluids. And this is not to be memorized, because we can measure fluids, what's in them, and figure out what the mechanism that's leading to the fluid in places in body cavities. Pleural cavity, pericardial sac, peritoneal cavity. Those are the three main cavities you think of where fluid can accumulate. A transurethral is a term you'll hear where you have a specific gravity greater than one. What's the specific gravity? Mass per unit volume is one. So your water is one. So edema is going to have low protein content because of increased hydrostatic pressure, for example, and very little cells, and the specific gravity is less than 1.02, but it's still higher than water. It has other molecules besides that protein. Now we call what you'll hear is an exudate. An exudate means you have higher permeability, but it's not only letting more protein in, but more cells, lymphocytes, like pus. Acute inflammation. This is called an exudate when pus gets into tissue or into in this case, body cavity. We call it empyema. Now, that's obviously going to have more solutes or larger molecules in cells, so the specific gravity is going to be higher than water. And so it depends on what you're going to look for. If it's pus, you know it's acute inflammation, right? A pussy exudate, like empyema we talked about, pus in a cavity. It could be fibrinous, where you have basically fibrin being deposited on the surface because of inflammation. Like in the heart, if you have a pericarditis, inflammation of the surface. Can you have combos? You can have purulent or fibropurulent. So you can have both a lot of protein, fibrin, as a clotting process, as well as pus. You can have eosinophils, allergic reaction to drugs, to parasites. And last but not least, blood can get into body cavities. What beverage, what alcoholic beverage has the word, has the meaning blood in it? Not Bloody Mary. I knew you were going to think of that. What's another? As red wine, sangria. Because what does sangria mean? Means blood. So what type of exudate would you call this? A sanguineous exudate. So when I see a sangria, I think of a sanguineous exudate. Because it's full of blood. Okay? So you can call it a serosanguineous, proteinaceous, and blood. So that's an exudate. That's very common. Okay. Congestion is a very important thing. So congestion has two types. One is good, one is evil. What's this based on? Hypoxia. That's why it's going to be. So if you have hypoxia, one of these congestions is bad. And it makes sense when you think about it. When we talk about active congestion, remember we talked about rubor and acute inflammation. That's good. Why is that good? Because I'm releasing these vasodilators we talked about, What happens to blood flow? It increases, but what happens to oxygen content now in the tissue? Increases. That's good, because it takes a lot of oxygen to go through the, allow the neutrophils to go through the process to get rid of dead tissue or the inflammation. That's good. Another type of congestion where we have dilation of vessels, that's all it means, is dilated vessels, is passive congestion. This is more of a mechanical problem where blood backs up, whether it's the heart failing, you have a thrombus, or you have some type of compression on blood flow, and it builds up in the capillaries. So what's going to happen to the oxygen content as a function of time? If the blood is not moving out of tissue, whatever the reason, what's going to happen to the oxygen content in that capillary bed? It drops because the cells have to live. They're taking up the oxygen. So what are they dumping in there is CO2. So what's going to happen to the pH in that blood? So now it becomes acidotic. Now we got a problem. And cells don't like to live in an acid environment, and they can start now to become damaged. And so that's why this type of congestion is evil. So congestive heart failure, when you see patients with congestive heart failure, you see that edema, but remember the oxygen content in that tissue is what? Lower. And that's not good. So you don't want a patient having chronic heart failure because they're going to cause damage to their tissues, leading to scarring or fibrosis. So this is how you look at it. This is a diagram taken from your textbook to illustrate the following. We have a circuit. That's why it's important to look at the tissue or patient and think of it as a circuit. You have blood going into it that's arterial, that's oxygenated. You have nutrients. But then you get the capillaries. It's going to be taken up as you go through the capillary bed and release CO2, waste products, and you have less oxygen, the blue. So when I have, what happens to your blood vessels when you exercise? Dilate. Why? Because you need more what? Right. That's good. Not a problem. But now, if I obstruct the blood flow, what do you notice? They dilate the vessels, but what happens to the O2? And that's evil. Now you're going to lead to hypoxia. So this is a very important concept. You always have to think of when you look at tissues of the human body, or even an animal, it doesn't matter. They all have circulation, right? So this has become, that's why I said, when you look at this topic, what's the underlying problem you always have to worry about, you're trying to avoid, is hypoxia. That's the number one thing. I don't care if you're a nurse, physical therapist, physician, nurse practitioner, social worker, anybody touches a patient, pharmacist. These are important concepts because you're going to recognize. You may be the first one to recognize it. People think their body's getting swollen. They think they're getting fat. They'll never think of, do you think people understand about edema, the normal average person? No. But you're going to be their interpreter for them. Just listen to them. Their body gives away what's going on. Now we come to a food. How many people like to cook? Good. Cooking is good. Saves money, too. And you make what you like. Here is the nutmeg for those that are in the cocina or the kitchen. How many colors do you see in cross-section? Two. One light, one dark. Now, when you have congestion, let's say your right side of the heart fails, the blood's going to back up into the inferior and superior vena cava. One of the organs that has a lot of blood vessels in it is your liver. So what happens is, when that blood backs up in your liver, it looks like this. You can see the fresh tissue. You see two colors. See the dark red areas? And then you see the pale area around it. When you look at the histology of a lobular unit, each tissue has a unique circulation to it. It has the portal triads at the edge, where blood is coming in from the hepatic artery and portal vein. But in the center is the vein, which draining as the blood goes through the vascular channels to the central vein. Those dark areas, each one of these, represents the dark area of that nutmeg. This is the center of the central lobe unit. So this is what's going to have the oxygen content in those dead dark red areas. What's going to happen over a period of time if it backs up into there? Decrease. So this is passive congestion. So now you can damage your liver permanently with scar tissue if this persists. The lighter area represents where the blood is coming in that's trying to flow to the middle of this lobular unit. And right here in the left lower corner is the inferior vena cava. The inferior vena cava, before it gets to your heart, passes behind the liver. What's draining into that from the liver is your hepatic veins. So now if your right heart fails, the hydrostatic pressure goes up in the inferior vena cava, it's transmitted into the veins in the liver, and it backs up, and we call this a nutmeg liver, because it has how many colors? One dark, one light. And you'll hear this term, nutmeg. What do you think is going to happen to the size of this liver in this patient? It swells. Why? Well, what happens to hydrostatic pressure? Goes up, and so what's going to happen to the tissue is edema. Fluid plus the veins are going to dilate, and you're going to have more mass because of the red blood cells. What does it look like microscopically? It looks like this. This is not to be memorized. I'm not going to show you this photograph, but I'll show you. It's the concept. I'm just using the liver to show it. Here is a portal triad where you have a portal vein. You have a hepatic artery, bile duct, and you see one here, and one here. But what's in the center? You see there's more blood there because you see the dark area. So it's that vein. What's going to happen to the oxygen content for those hepatocytes? Go down, you have a hypoxic injury. So having somebody with passive congestion is what? Good or bad? Bad because you're leading to what form of cell injury? Hypoxia. No, hypoxia, then eventually you're going to replace the tissue with scar tissue. Don't skip steps. Take it one at a time. All right? It's a domino effect. Let's talk about start hemostasis. Now, here's the issue. This also involves hypoxia. It's how you look at this. We know we have to protect the intravascular volume, our blood, whether it's in the veins, capillaries, arteries, and our chambers of the heart. If there's a hole or there's some way that blood leaves that space, what's going to happen to oxygen delivery to tissue? Decrease. So you lead to hypoxia. So now we lead to shock. We have decreased intravascular volume. So now we have to plug it up. So we have to devise a system that has three components that makes a plug that plugs up the hole where the damage has occurred, somewhere along that circuit. But we have a problem here. If we make the plug too big, what's going to happen to blood flow locally within that tissue? So you lead to what form of cell injury? Hypoxia. See, here's the dilemma. I've got to develop a system to plug up the holes inside the intravascular space, a plug. We call that a hemostatic plug. We'll go through the three components that help make this. If I make the plug too big, what's going to happen to blood flow locally? I lead to hypoxia, I lead to infarct locally. So here's, I'm trying to avoid, so it's got to be delicately balanced. So we break it down to three components. The critical thing is anything that damages the blood vessel wall, what happens to its leakiness? Goes up. So what are things that can make your blood vessels leaky so you start bleeding spontaneously in your tissues, internal bleeding, or in your skin? Is vasculitis. So if you had PMNs that has collagenase and elastase being released into that wall, what is that blood vessel wall made out of? Is elastin and collagen. So now you digest it, it's going to be stronger or weaker now? Weaker. So what's the likelihood of it blowing apart and releasing blood into the tissue? Increase. So that's an example. Well, let's try something, a vitamin deficiency. If you had somebody who had vitamin C deficiency, we call it scurvy. What is vitamin C? It's an important cofactor for the cross-linking of collagen. So what do you think would happen if you don't get vitamin C? What do you think to the structural integrity of those vessels? Decrease, and you have bleeding problems. So minor trauma to your skin, you would see a bruise. We call that an ecchymosis. So the first thing you want to, when you have a patient who has a bruise or bleeding or ecchymosis in the skin or petechial hemorrhage, just pinpoint, is it a problem with the vessel wall? Next component, to make that plug, we have to have parts of a cell from the megakaryocyte living in your bone marrow we call platelets. These platelets are going to have to bind to the wall. Remember, blood's flowing through the vascular conduits on both the arterial, capillary, and venous side, or in the chambers of the heart. So we have to have some type of way of anchoring it so it doesn't get pulled off because all that blood hitting it. So we have to use platelets to adhere to it to start to make the plug. Where are your platelets made? In your bone marrow. So what are some of the ways you don't have enough platelets? Is you had leukemia. Let's say you have a malignancy that destroys your bone marrow. Drugs, viruses, radiation. There are many things that can destroy your bone marrow. And one of the problems of destroying your bone marrow, you can't make platelets, you can't clot very well. So you have bleeding problems. You brush your teeth, you got a cup of blood in the sink. When you brush your teeth or floss your teeth, do you have a cup of blood in your sink? You're producing trauma to your gums because hemostasis is taking care of that injury. But if it is damaged, if somebody had scurvy and they brushed their teeth, they'd be spitting up blood. Or if they had leukemia, don't have megakaryocytes, they'd be coughing up or spitting out blood. So that means there's some type of injury to a very vascular tissue. So platelets, if you destroy the bone marrow, there are diseases we're going to talk about that what consume the platelets. The third component you have to look at, because this is a plug, we have to give it cement. And the cement we do, the third component is to tighten this plug so it doesn't get torn off, is fibrin, clotting factors. We're taking a polymer, fibrinogen, and converting it to a polymer. It's like making mortar for bricks. Think of the platelets as the bricks, and think of the fibrin as the mortar that makes that a strong structural support. What is the organ, or what is the cell in the organ that makes this, the clotting factors? The clotting factors is your liver, the hepatocytes. So if you had a patient who had damaged their liver, cirrhosis, or they had mushroom poisoning early on in life and it scarred the liver permanently, and they couldn't make enough albumin to get anasarca because they don't have enough chloroncotic pressure, plus they can't make clotting factors, now they have bleeding problems because they can't make the third component. So when you see a patient with a bruise, the first three things you think of the patient is it a problem with the vessel wall? Is it a problem with the platelets? Oh, by the way, what's a common drug that people take is aspirin. Aspirin acetylates the platelets to make them not sticky, to avoid making a thrombus in a vessel like their brain or heart, to avoid a stroke or a heart attack. So when you go to surgery, and if you've been taking aspirin, what does a surgeon tell you to do? Stop taking the aspirin at least a week before you go to surgery. So that when they cut you, that you have good hemostasis, you're not bleeding, and you require a lot of transfusions. So drugs can affect the platelets or the bricks and not allow them to adhere to it. If you have people with renal failure and you have toxins building up, they can interfere with the platelets and also make you leakier or bleeding. So that's how you look at a patient. You break down, is it a vessel wall problem? Is it a platelet problem? Or is it a clotting factor problem? Because all of this is important for hemostasis. So when we look at this, the cell that is in your blood vessels and in your heart are what we call endothelial cells. These cells are critical. We saw it in the case of what? Inflammation. Remember the rolling of the acute inflammatory cells, the neutrophils, and sticking to it and getting out? Well, they're also critical in how you form a hemostatic plug. So they do it, it's a yin and yang. They're going to promote it, and they want to inhibit it at the same time, because what's the problem? We don't want to get too big, because if it does, we're going to lead to local loss of blood flow leading to hypoxic damage. But we still got to make it big enough so it doesn't get torn off and I leak more blood out, and then I've got hypoxic injury everywhere. So that's the dilemma. So what's the cell that's critical to regulate this? Is your endothelial cells. That's why when you brush your teeth, you don't see any bleeding, because who's been working? You're traumatizing the vessels, their hemostatic platelets are circulating, and you don't get any blood. But if you have problems there, like if you have gingivitis, you have inflammation. What are your blood vessels going to be if you have gingivitis? They're already vasodilated. So they're leaking to begin with. Some minor trauma, like brushing your teeth, what do you get? Blood, don't you? Okay? So what are the factors? We'll leave it on this note. There are things, we'll come back and look at this. Tissue factor is part of the coagulation cascade that's found within your endothelial cells, causing any damage. It'll set off the production of fibrin. We have these molecules called von Willebrand's factor that's made by the endothelial cells to make the ability of the platelets to stick to the vessel wall. Otherwise, they have no way of anchoring. And it's called what's von Willebrand's disease. We also have thromboxane, a prostaglandin. Thromboxane, you can see, tries to make it cause platelet aggregation, vasoconstriction to slow down the blood so that you can form a hemostatic plug. But at the same time, we don't want this plug to get too big, so we have to have other factors that inhibit this or regulate it tightly. There is a protein that's released from the endothelial cells that activates plasminogen, the plasmin that helps break down the fibrin so it doesn't get too much. We have the opposite prostaglandin. That's a vasodilator and inhibits platelet aggregation. And we have other molecule called thrombomodulin that takes two proteins made by the liver, protein C and S, and helps cleave the clotting factors to avoid making too much mortar or fibrin. So what are the three factors? As we leave today, we think of what three factors that will affect somebody keeping their blood in their vessels is what? Vessel wall integrity, platelets, and clotting factors. So next time you get a bruise, just think of what happened. On that note, have a bruise-free day. This podcast was recorded by Dr. Henry Sanchez at the University of California, San Francisco.